I would normally launch into a sermon without any sort of apologies, right? But I feel that one is necessary, and all of the, like, even the minor sort of AV glitches, I'm pretty sure all my fault, because when I hopped out of the shower this morning, I started out putting on my son's underwear, okay? And he is not the size I am. So that I should have called ahead, really, and just let you guys know, you're joining me on one of those days. So saddle up. Okay, that being said, I didn't leave him on. And we'll just leave it at that. A few weeks ago, I was asked to describe my personal theology. Apparently it's a thing they do in seminary, right? So they wanted to hear what my idea of God was. So I said that I had a sense of something that's larger than all of us, that's a unifying energy, something beyond our understanding, that connected us in ways that we're able to experience ourselves from time to time, if we are attentive. So the reply I got to my answer was, so you just haven't figured out the rest of it then? Okay, I thought I'd really nailed that down, right? I had nailed it. But for this person, my answer sounded like the theology of a child. Unformed, unsophisticated, I came across like a believer. But I am a believer. But it's important to make a distinction at this point. I am not a believer, okay? I'm not a believer, I'm a believer. And it's funny to say that, but the odd thing is that in a lot of my conversations with UUs, the reaction from many of the people would be about the same. If I were to say that I was a believer or that I was a believer, the gut response that I get back from people is along the lines of, well, surely not. He seems too smart for that. And I have to say, I'm hesitant to disagree with that, okay? I like to be smart. But the truth is that my answer to the question of personal theology was as well stated as I could make it. As Unitarian Universalists, we are forced to answer this question without a handbook. There's no dogma to memorize that makes the answer to this question easy. We can't answer on behalf of anyone else, even in our own congregation. Every one of us has to dig deep and answer for ourselves. Until I was asked to answer directly about, you know, to name my personal theology, I always answered in relation to other belief systems, right? So in discussion about the Trinity or the Triune God or any of that, I would say that Unitarians haven't believed in the divinity of Jesus for hundreds of years, and Unitarian Universalists don't require belief in God. In a discussion about salvation, sin and salvation, I would point out that UUs don't believe in heaven, and that we don't really then have a need for salvation. Whatever evil's in the world is carried around by the acts of people, right? So we don't really need salvation. In discussion about sacraments, I point out that UUs didn't keep any of the seven original Christian sacraments, but that we celebrate life events with community rituals. So I felt that helps us define kind of where we stand. But when I find myself in discussions about the meaning of sacraments and rituals and other faiths, I find myself mostly with my foot in my mouth. And in fact, I spend so much time in that condition, just especially over the last few months, that my toes are like little raisins, right? Late in a long discussion of an even longer document full of arguments for and against creating an ecumenical communion service, I could no longer see the point. It was far too much tedious talk about who could bless, who could serve, who could partake in the rite of communion, and what the rite was supposed to mean to each person who took it. And it went on for a long time. So I asked to the class, what does communion mean to you guys personally? Like, what do you experience in taking communion at your own church that makes it worth this much discussion about what happens at other churches? The first answers I got back were highly technical and very dogmatic, going as far as to explain the episcopal succession of authority, and let me get this right, in the substitutionary atonement theology, right? So to me, I was feeling like my question about personal experience hadn't been answered, right? Because I'm a word nerd. I don't think I'd use the word substitutionary in describing my own experience. So I followed up and asked, I said, okay, I understand the intellectual and logistical sides of this, but I want to know what they experienced, not what they learned. That it turns out, was a step way too far, and they took me to task. So what followed was a scene where I, very imperfectly, practiced patience and listening skills. It was very imperfect. But I practiced being patient and silent while student after student told me how rude and dismissive I had been of their faith. See, it may be easy to answer our difficult questions by pointing comparisons to the dogma of others, but what they heard, and this is what I learned from that rather comprehensive feedback, was that what they hear is a series of statements that deny the basis of their religion one point after another. What they heard me say is, no, there is no salvation. The only value to sacraments is social. Jesus is not God. It's the theological equivalent of saying, wrong, wrong. That's what I was doing to them. Knowing this, I can understand why so many of them revealed their experiences with not just me, but with other UUs as being dismissive or outright rude, they felt, to people of other faith traditions. So I get that now. It took a long time in this discussion to come to the understanding that I did not have an intimate experience with communion, and I wanted to hear one. The first person who spoke up against my behavior ended up sharing a deeply heartfelt and beautiful story about their first communion and their experience of near physical transformation from the feeling of from the buildup to the event that just kind of changed how they viewed their religion entirely. It was a beautiful story. But not only did they share that life-changing moment, they admitted that they didn't share it earlier when I had asked because they were embarrassed to tell a story of real, direct, sacred experience in front of their fellow Christian classmates. They too were afraid of being seen as childish. They were afraid of being seen as credulous. So what they expressed in that experience of communion was a direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. That's one of the UU six sources of wisdom. It's one of my favorites. There's a philosophy that Mary Chase introduced in a play in 1944. That exemplifies this same source of wisdom, the direct experience, from another point of view. It could be called Taoism, or maybe just the way of the invisible rabbit. Here's the quote. Harvey and I sit in the bars, have a drink or two, play the jukebox, and soon The faces of all the other people, they turn toward mine and they smile. And they're saying, "We don't know your name, mister, but you're a very nice fellow." Harvey and I warm ourselves in all these golden moments. We entered as strangers, soon we have friends, and they come over, and they sit with us, and they drink with us, and they talk to us. They tell about the big, terrible things they've done and the big, wonderful things they'll do. Their hopes and their regrets and their loves and their hates, all very large, because nobody ever brings anything small into a bar. And then I introduce them to Harvey, and he's bigger and grander than anything they offer me. And when they leave impressed. So Elwood P. Dowd, the speaker of this quote, is showing me what it would look like if I do my job well, to remain open to the transcending mystery and wonder that other people bring, those stories that aren't told in my words. Elwood didn't just listen to their stories. He sat openly in a place where people bring their big things, comfortably hanging out with his own sense of wonder. So I like that image of how we can accept the big things that other people bring. I think what Elwood says in Chase's play about not bringing anything small into a bar holds true for our congregations as well. There's a reason that we come to a church. There's something about this that reminds us of that connection. So it wouldn't be fair of me at this point not to share what I believe, right? And I know I put it into words, but we're gonna try that again. And the main thing is my sense of wonder and mystery and my belief in what connects us does not have anything to do with a 6 foot, 3.5 inch rabbit that no one else can see, okay? So I think that's important. When I think of God, it's not the anthropomorphic sort of decision-making, bearded, dressed. That's not what I think of for that transcending mystery. It's also not retrospective. I think that when we think about God a lot, and when I hear back from my family members who use a lot of God language, that when I hear back from them, where they tell me God is in the gaps between a thing that happened that they understand and another thing that happened that they understand, right? So you have these two islands. So when I had my heart attack, there was an island of the event, and then there was the island over here where I woke up, right? Didn't expect that, kind of didn't see that coming. There's an unfathomable gap that people were telling me God had his hand on you. I was skeptical because the God that would make decisions at that level about me also decided you're on the heart attack list, right? So if it's a deciding person, that to me isn't an unknowable thing that connects us all. It's one of those faces that we find that makes people feel less frightened by what caused them to want a God in the first place. So you take it way back. Let's go back thousands of years. We all run into things that we don't understand. There are people that we're sitting with here that we have to wonder, how did I come to be here with them? How did this person enter my life, and why did it turn out so good? I couldn't have made a decision that good myself. So we have this mystery around us in small ways. If we go back farther, those gaps between what people understood to be true are huge, right? So three children are born. Two of them die, one doesn't. Must be a reason for that. When your tribe is the one that survives, and you look back and you see these stories where it looks like somebody else should have, right? Your ancestor was the third son of a nobody. It's your story to look at and say, well, then God chose him to bring us here, right? So there were some big gaps. Those gaps got closer and narrower the more we understood about how things worked. That seems to leave very little room for the mystery, right? Where's the transcendence in that? Those gaps that are closing, those are the gaps between things when we're looking backwards. The only things we understand, or even think we understand, are when we look behind us at what already happened and then make some decisions about why they happened or how. So you can say we know what's going on, the whole world is connected. We are connected in truth to yesterday's whole world. It's very rare that we are connected to even one person to know what's going on if they're not in our visible range, if they're not in our telephone range, if they're not on our telephone at the time. Where the mystery in life really was and still is today unchanged, it's right here. It's the right now. Our arguments about where God is and about what things are important and how things fit together, that's all looking behind us. And our ability to remember them is what shapes how we think of it in the first place. So if there's a way to turn around and look at the now, that's, I think, what Unitarian Universalism is trying to bring forward. When we talk about spirit, we're talking about, and it's described in there, that we're looking at this 360-degree view of spirit, right? So it's what you do here and now. It's not for gain in the future for yourself. It's not for finding an afterlife that works for you. And it's not for use in arguments about things that have already happened. It's being present now. So when we look at how we relate, what are some of the things we share? What's our face on that balloon, right? Because if the balloon is that force, is that mystery, is that thing, that connecting, unifying business that we can't understand, and we're drawing faces on it and arguing about how the faces look, we can move around and look at that from someone else's point of view to start to build those bridges. Tricky part about that is, we're in the balloon. That's what now is. To pretend that we can take this balloon and say, well, this is God and we've got a face here and a face there. In truth, whatever it is that the universe is, we're inside of it. So it's like cave paintings. We're inside that balloon. We're painting faces on the inside. And imagining by doing that, that it's manageable enough and small enough to be outside of us. So if we're all in the balloon together, all in this thing that we can't see, but we know there's part of it, there's part of something in the universe that holds us together and helps us to wonder, that means we're standing back to back with the people that are looking at a different picture than we are. We don't really need to move. We don't need to walk around. That's an illusion. We're all in the center of this right now. Everybody who needs our help is somewhere now. And when we run into them and are able to provide help, it's still going to be now. So how we move from this completely unformed, undefinable, who knows what's going to happen future, it moves through this little spark of the present and takes form in a past that gets concretized and recorded. And then we can argue about it and we're happy. But looking at the spark of now that we're always riding in, Unitarian Universalism wants those hopes for the future, the fears for the future, the actions of the past. We want that concentrated, I think, on what's going on now. Who needs help now? How do we make that work? And I think that it's possible that the transcendent mystery and wonder, that actual feeling you get when you feel the connection, when it actually goes on for you, that could be the manifestation of doing today the work that's in front of you that needs to be done today. That's a guess. When we look back at this, we can argue about how right I was. What we can do is we can look for the arguments for love in the things that other people share with us. We can make sure that we don't rely on someone else's belief when we're talking to them in order to describe the message of love that we're trying to get out there. That's what's going to help us to move from what I experienced as my irresponsible search for truth and meaning, because I wasn't considering the effect that I had in leaning on these other people, using their history to describe my now. Looking for the love means that we're all in the moment together, and we can find some commonalities, build some bridges, and use those to fix the roads that all of the traveling souls cross.